the 22 trumps tell this sort of story, and this is your alchemical progression. But if it was just meant to be in one direct order from 0 to 21, they would have printed it as a book, and that's how it would be. But they're put on cards. They're meant to be shuffled. This is the cut-up technique. This is Burroughs. This is where we get to something really interesting. So that Valis loop, if it is a magnetic tape, what you can then do is cut up snippets of it and reassemble it. So you get to be the editor of it. And ultimately, if you shuffle the tarot, if you mix up the story, what we might be stuck with is that these archetypes are the basic elements, elemental structure of reality. So we might be stuck with only a certain number of ingredients, but we get to remix that any number of ways. And to me, the idea of what happens with dogma is that someone comes in and says, this alchemical narrative or this monomyth, this is the story. To me, that's artistic fascism. That's philosophical fascism. You know, that's really dogmatic, disgusting approach. But if you view that monomyth, that story, that alchemical narrative as a reboot, then it serves its purpose. If you forget what these pieces are, you can always assemble them back into the original Valis loop, the original Saturnian cycle, and then you can understand, oh, okay, this is this archetype, and it gives you enough context to understand it. But then ultimately, what we want to do something interesting is to remix it. So this is like, you know, we could take this as James Joyce, shuffling it to such an extent that you're confused as to what it's even approaching. But we can always go back and reboot the system, listen to that original narrative as just a way of going, oh, okay, this is context, and now I can identify these archetypes, these different elements of the story. But I'm with you. Smash the cycle. Like, absolutely. Smash the time loop. But that does, you know, to me, that's what it's meant to do. There's a reason that Osiris is dismembered. So we only time we Isis brings him back together is to procreate. You know, she puts him back together to create Horus. So this is the idea of like, okay, then we start that cycle all over again. Horus is going to grow up. He's going to become, essentially, he's going to start that cycle all over again. So it's just a reboot. But ultimately, we should break him up, recycle him, you know, shuffle it up. This is cut up. This is, to me, this is innovation. This is interesting. And this is what we're meant to do in life. Anything else is fascism.
Freud's The Uncanny for how he did it. And so I went and I found Freud's The Uncanny and I read it. The book is much larger. The final section is The Uncanny. So they call the whole book The Uncanny, but really it's number of essays all grouped, which is what they commonly do with that kind of thing. But anyways, half the thing, or at least a good portion of it, is talking about the idea of insemination, like seeing life in something that is, we would consider lifeless. And the feeling that is aroused in that in people, if they consider that it's real, is one of not just terror, but he's saying a specific kind of response which is considered uncanny. So, like, there's an element of terror, it's a fear involved, but going into the psychology of why that fear arises. And, like, me in my room right now, I'm just, like, surrounded by toys. I have so many fucking toys. I have Star Wars toys all over the floor and fucking all kinds of stuff everywhere. And there's definitely something that I continually tripped out on is, like, when we form shapes and how, with our imagination, we can imbue them with life to a degree. And then just that on top of the whole putting a god before the source, you know, like, you, as soon as you inseminate something with life, that's what they would call, like, you know, idolatry or whatever. But we do this automatically, and there's almost no way around it. In fact, our whole psychostructure is built off of it because of the coping mechanism to try and localize ourselves and build a holographic model of ourselves in order to know, in order to kind of give the ego some autonomy, you know, which is, you know, like, I don't know, it's why we experience expansion when someone compliments us and why we contract if someone insults us. It's like everything's dependent upon this this thing that we make, that we project of ourselves. And so I was considering, like, if people look at a wall, there's like stucco patterns or whatever, how, or whatever, look at clouds, like, what is this fucking, like, compulsion to see faces in it? You know, you see faces, like, just about everybody does it, you know, and where does that come from, and what is that about, you know? And so I think that there's something to be said about film and the way that we're looking to generate these models and these things, and how, what satisfaction we get when it, the more real it looks, you know, and where that comes from, you know, other than just to prove that we can. It seems that there's some compulsive element at play in it, and there's a reason why, beyond the obvious, that it's so satisfying, you know.
Do you, you know, I could sort of take that in one of two ways. Like, in one respect, the toys are like a homunculus or a golem, even, this idea of this thing that we've created, and then we can choose to look at it with an with animated eyes. And that's something I'd kind of like to talk to you guys about, because I see Hal in 2001 as very much the same thing. So we could take it in the Kubrick direction, but I wonder if the idea of seeing this thing with terror, these uncanny imbued life forces, isn't, you know, if we're Westerners having this conversation, for an Easterner, you know, the idea that everything has a life force in it, a rock, a tree, you know, there, that these are all imbued with spirit. And I wonder if that would be a less strange idea, and it's only for us that we kind of get freaked out, the same way someone, you know, in the West, we tell ghost stories as a scary thing. You know, in any paranormal experience or UFO experience, whatever it is that someone's encountering something out of the ordinary, people are usually freaked out by it. But I wonder if we were in a culture that sort of more recognized that there were other energies, even if it's a part of ourselves.
Right.
Well, the thing about toys, if I just want to throw in real quick, I mean, Kubrick's last unofficial film is exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
The whole image of David, when he comes home, the mother is freaked out.
Yeah.
She can't even look at it. And then over the next week or month or whatever it is, she grows to love it. She somehow, the robot doesn't change. It just pulls out of her love and her emotion, and it becomes, the flesh that covers it becomes sort of inseminated by her emotion, and to the point where she had, at the end of their relationship, instead of sending the hunk of metal and gears and wires to be destroyed, she sets it free somehow. She can't see it, quote-unquote, die, even though there's nothing there to die. But really, it's just her own emotions that are she can't see go away. So it's that whole thing, right, is all that what that movie is all about.
I like that.
You know, I had done something for The Mask of God, which was, you know, I think in AI, it's very much a homunculus. You know, it is the little man. But for something that I had thought about with Hal is the idea of a golem, this idea that you would take this figure, this clay figure, and then you inscribe a name on it, and then it'll do anything you want it to do. And then it was this idea that if you change the letters on its forehead, it would become uncontrollable, and then you had to rectify what was written. And not to give the punchline away, but to first explore, when you see Hal, he has all those circuit boards with those sort of numbers and letters on them. And you mm-hmm. see that very much as that, where, like, he's out of control, and Dave Bowman and then later Dr. Chandra has to sort of correct what's written there. Now, the golem story, what has to be written there is the word truth. And you see in 2010, when Dr. Chandra arrives, how malfunctioned because he was lied to. He was told to lie. So it was only at the moment that the word truth, or the truth, was altered, that he became uncontrollable and was killing his masters. And what Chandra has to do, he said, you know, I forget the exact line, but Hal and Chandra have this conversation, and Hal says, "Thank you for telling me the truth. You know, I understand now. Thank you for telling me the truth." And suddenly the golem is back on course. So it's like, seems... I don't know if it's intentional or not, but that seems very explicitly in line with that mythology.
Yeah, my rabbi has a book from the, I think it's actually maybe even 14th century. I mean, he doesn't have the original, he has a print of it, but it's the, like, official How to Generate a Golem book written in, I don't know, it might be written in Hebrew, but I think it might be written in Aramaic. But basically... there's this whole part of it where they have the letters of the Hebrew alphabet in a circle, and you basically generate a geometry by connecting in a particular combination, visualizing one letter to the next across the circle, and basically you make it more and more rapid. And the amount of concentration it would take to actually do what they're saying would need to be done is, like, fucking unbelievable, because the thing is supposedly birthed from your, they say literally, like, it translates as the middle brain. So this thing comes out of your head. it's kind of crazy. And it's that you're an extension of the creator. It's not like the way that one would expect, I think, if they had certain assumptions about the demonic or whatever, you know? Because the thing is still, people say it's soulless, you know, but in a sense it has a spark of life. You're giving it a spark of life, you know? But I don't know. I don't know. Go deeper and deeper into it, and just further and further reflecting you back, through the mechanics of it. Because we have mechanics, but that's not ultimately who we are.
But isn't that basically what you were saying? The idea that your golem is sort of a projection of your middle brain. It's you yourself sort of in that figure. Then it would be a reflection.
think it's interesting we're talking about the dark glass. You know, obviously you have in Donnie Darko, the rabbit opens up a wormhole in the movie screen. So you have, again, like the Alice goes down the rabbit, she goes through the rabbit hole and also through the looking glass. But something that I come back to, I learned when Chris Myers wrote this piece for the Sync book, he has this like few sentences that really stuck with me. It says, spiritualist William Crookes had invented the Crookes tube after scrying in a black mirror as a way to communicate with spirits. Now, besides the Crookes tube leading to the discovery of electrons and later X-rays, it was used to invent the original standard TV. Spiritualist John Logie Bard, born 1888, who invented the television itself, had said in his own book that he was in the contact that he was in contact with the spirit of Thomas Edison. So this idea
that
the black
tied it all together,
like looking for spirits through the black mirror, through the dark glass, leads to the television, which is of course the home cube. It's the movie theater brought into a cube in the home.
It's a cube within the cube. That's fucking perfect. I didn't know that. And so that's the thing with mirrors, is that they were just glass. You know, I mean, they're polished glass, basically. Now they're different, I think. I think you can still get mirrors like that, but, you know, that's strange. Thinking about a television set turned off, that's black thing that's just there, and then it illuminates, you know?
Right.
Oh, far out.
Now,
well, it's interesting to have grown up in an age where the television itself would turn off, where programming would stop.
Yeah.
To be up late at night and then to just wake up to static. That has to have been an epic leap forward for, you know, media, to where media was on and then it was off. There were breaks, much like I think how our consciousness was at a very early part in our evolution. We were awake and we were totally asleep. But on some level, we're awake in our dreams and we're awake in our reality 24 hours a day, nonstop. And learning how to deal with that river of thought is, you know, is the key to sanity in this world.
I believe we're now joined by Jason Barrera. Jason, are you there?
Yes, for the moment I'm here. I don't know how long this will last.
For the moment, right.
Hmm.
Jason is trapped on the other side of the scrying glass.
Yes.
We're talking about mirrors and the movie screen as monolith, Donnie Darko. I'm sure anything you could possibly throw at us would be sinky as hell.
I was just looking at Full Metal Jacket, where the exiting the movie thing is also a recurrent motif, as is in all of Kubrick's movies. But I'm not sure what you guys have been talking about here.
Where is that in Full Metal Jacket?
There's a movie theater when they're with the prostitute, and the second prostitute with the cream in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in a movie theater, and they're sitting in movie chairs.
What's the film that they're playing there? Do you know? It's like a Western?
It's a John Wayne Western.
Oh.
Of course.
But I'm not sure which one.
Because Private Joker is John Wayne. He says, right, he does.
Is that you, John Wayne? Is this me?
Yeah. So it's John Wayne's theater. Now, are we talking about John Wayne Gacy or John Wilkes Booth?
I have a draft where all this is explained, but when they get to the theater, they go through the door and exit the movie, which is the same as 2001, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
How do you connect the whole... It sticks out to me that Animal Mother has a line about where he uses the word nigger, right? And mm-hmm. and so does Grady when he's talking in the conversation to Jack. And mm-hmm. that this is a word that sort of is, it signifies understanding of their positions in the world. And, you know, with everything in Kubrick, it's a deliberate choice in the moment. And Animal Mother takes the prostitute into the theater and he says, I go first. Right after he had said something about black people being less than white people. And granted, in that sort of soldier speak, it's taken as just humor, dark humor, and a comment just on the horror of their situation. But I'm wondering if that has any relation to a black mirror or a darkness or something.
Well, there's what Freud in The Interpretation of Dreams has to say about if a white person sees a black person in a dream and what that represents for them, and the fear that it brings up is the shadow. And then Carl Jung ran with that notion of the shadow, which is the basis for Full Metal Jacket, that the enemy you never actually see, that it's actually themselves. It seems like we're shooting the wrong gooks, we're filming the wrong gooks, that we have seen the enemy and it is us, and that the only way that they can continue to destroy the enemy as long as they're destroying themselves. And then that breakdown that they're experiencing within themselves and losing their innocence is basically just that.
Bill pointed out that the Lego Tower we were talking about before was built in Korea. This giant record-setting Lego Tower was built in Korea, but just because Gook is actually a reference to Koreans, which is where they would say Hanguk means to be Korean. So it's not, you know, for Western ears, it's a derogatory term, but it's not. It's sort of based on an actual nationality. So when they're using that phrase, even though they're using the phrase in Vietnam, in this movie, of course, they're saying it. It's like in Big Lebowski when the Big Lebowski in the wheelchair, the wounded king, he says something like, I had my legs blown off by a Chinaman in Korea. You know, it's this sort of like mixed, I think perhaps like an intentional mistaken, even in the derogatory slang, they're making a mistake of sort of lumping everything together and sort of showing the ignorance, perhaps.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Why? Yeah, we're gonna go to this. I thought I would go visit another country, meet the people, whatever, learn the customs. I forget what the actual quote is, and then you know, kill them. You know, like complete lack of understanding of their culture is necessary in order to just rationalize what you're doing.
Well, just from an emotional standpoint, when I started to bring up the point of the scenes in Full Metal Jacket and The Shining where the word nigger is used, in my body, I could feel myself tense up before I said it. And I knew in my mind, I said, can I use that word? Should I say the N-word? Should I preface it by saying they refer to African Americans as the N-word? There were all these different pathways I could have taken to communicate what essentially is just in a movie. It shouldn't be a reflection of my character or who people think I am. And it made me think of a word as a brick. And when thrown carelessly can cause great damage. And that, you know, nigger being it's the N-word. It is the king of words that start with N. When you say the N-word, there's only one word you really think of. And it's this whole idea of... this whole thing about Burroughs and what he said he loved most about Scientology was this idea of learning how engrams in your mind can cause dis-ease and can cause discomfort. and that the system of L. Ron Hubbard was to allow the person to confront these engrams embedded in their mind and to reduce their negative associations with it. And since Burroughs had such a deep feeling that language was a virus that had infected the human host and found a permanent home there, this was a profound way for him to find some healing and some insight into that fear. And Stanley Kubrick, you know, the monolith is a black brick. The logos and the wall are made of bricks. I think that this is a key point in when he uses that N-word, everyone can identify with an emotional reaction when they hear that. It might even be the one word that certain people remember most out of a Kubrick film when they hear it. And that's a peculiar construct, maybe just in the Western mind right now, but it is a peculiar symptom that can be diagnosed in humanity in the 20th century. How one word said at the wrong time can start a riot. And that is a power that we wield blindly, and to grasp how to wield that power for good or for evil seems to be everything about our political world, our social world. And if Burroughs found such insight in Scientology, and probably Jung and Freud would agree, and even Wilhelm Reich would agree, that it medically, a word can be a construct of our physical body and lead to health.
I was watching The Shining smoking DMT, and fucking Jack Nicholson turns into a reptile. It's the only experience I've ever had where I saw a fucking shape-shifting reptile with DMT, but it was in the bathroom scene when he's talking to Grady, and his face just started. At first, it looked like his face was going to explode, like it was just expanding in all directions, and in my room at the time, I only had one red light bulb above me, and so I was in this red room, and he's in the red fucking bathroom. And that totally went down. So I resonate with you in the red room of the 2001, where he looks like a reptile in terms of the cartoonish reflection. That's cool.
Well, what's fascinating is that at that key moment when Wendy finally locks Jack into his cell, a room which he could survive for months if it only had a bathroom. And then upstairs you have Bowman, who finally disconnects Hal. In the soundtrack, you hear the turning on of a television, and then Bowman turns over and he sees a television, and these messages of revelation start beaming out of the TV.
Bill, to me, that's one of the strongest connections. Like, that moment is one of the strongest connections in your arrangement of the Transformer. Like, that moment gave me shivers. Like, that was incredible.
Well, she says, you know, want to take a bath? What are you watching? I mean, it's just complete everything. It's like a big crunch, man. Everything is converging in that 3 minutes. And I haven't necessarily completed my own personal exegesis of what that means to me, but I know it's there. So if you have a chance to rewatch that sometime and share your thoughts, it'd be much appreciated.
what's the name that gets said in the Miss Bancroft?
Yes.
I don't know what that means. Have you thought about that? Have you looked into that, Miss Bancroft?
Bancroft, The Graduate?
Is that the name of the actress who plays Mrs. Robinson or something?
I haven't deciphered that movie clip completely.
Is that right? Is that the name of the actress in The Graduate?
It's the actress. Out. Yeah.
Yeah, we watched that the other night too. The Graduate. Huh. Okay.
Which, by the way, features so it's all Simon and Garfunkel. What I found myself meditating on last night was the idea that if there was a connection at the moment where Paul McCartney has his post 9/11 concert, David Bowie starts the concert up by singing the song America by Simon and Garfunkel. And it's a really, it's such a deep, there's like a million ways to run with this, because it seems ritualistic almost to have David Bowie come out and sing the song to open this thing. But at the same time, there's like the song, you know, says it evokes this sort of longing to find America and this idea of paranoia. You know, it says like we played games with the scenery. She says the man in the gabardine suit is a spy. I said, be careful. His bow tie is really a camera. Like it evokes this like paranoia, and it's beautifully this beautiful rendition. So it's, but like I said, you could run with it a million ways, but I was specifically wondering last night, what is the connection with Simon and Garfunkel? Like, I joked to myself, I was, bear in mind, I'm like, was on an 8-hour bus ride, so I just had time to just sit and like my mind wandering. But I was thinking to myself, another Simon and Garfunkel song is I Am a Rock.
Mm-hmm. I'm an island.
No man is an island, but in this song he says, "I am a rock." Well, So Bill says Manhattan is an island, but who do we go to war with after 9/11?
Iraq.
Yeah.
Iraq.
That's pretty good.
And Jason has pointed out that what we're really talking about here is the Philosopher's Stone. It's the Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's. I explain all of this in the book.
But I just.
It's Miss Foreign Affairs, essentially. It's all just Dr. Strangelove, and Iraq is Miss Foreign Affairs, and we're going to bomb the hell out of them.
So dropping bombs on them is the same thing as basically.
It was the shock and awe bombs.
Yeah. But okay, so I want to ask you a specific question. Is the shock and awe, when we say the Marilyn Monroe is a bombshell, right? The blonde bombshell. So here she is the missile. She's the warhead. But at the same time, this is very phallic stuff. So do we take this as this is the feminine armed with the phallus? You know.
No, it's the handmaid.
Well, if you refer back to Full Metal Jacket, you will see the scene where he says, "You will give your rifle a girl's name because it's the only pussy you people are going to get."
Charlene. But it's not actually the shot. It's the representation of her. It's the mirror image of her that's not really her. It's like her fucking evil twin. It's the handmaiden that's taken over the tree. That's the shell. That's the Kleepote. The Kleepote take over the tree. So the bombshell isn't actually Sakina, it's her representation. It's like, in her place, we have this character, which is the Lamed, you know.
Do you make a connection when you said that the handmaiden has taken over the tree? I'm sure this has been done in a lot of places, but I thought of Natalie Portman Star Wars movie where she pretends to be the handmaiden.
Right.
Where the handmaiden is actually the queen in disguise.
Totally. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that there's no It's like a Vedantic issue where it's like we're talking about an illusion, but there is no Maya without Brahm, right? And that Maya is actually Brahm, but it's like the false mask of Brahm, you know, that the mask isn't actually separate from the thing. It's not like there is anything else. Pan is the all. There's nothing beyond it, you know, but there's, you could call them outside forces, but there's no, you know, there's no reality to them other than the reality that they're inseminated with through the power of our imagination.
Yeah.
So I take it as that's like, in as far as our brain is concerned, it's in the mind. We have a representational holographic model of the thing that isn't actually the thing. And that if our vision was cleansed, you know, if the doors of perception were cleansed, we would see things as they are, which is infinite. But as long as we see birth, growth, decay, and death, we're not, you know, it's the Shakina becomes a bombshell. You know, we're not seeing her for what she is, which is united with Zaire. So the masculine and the feminine principles tie everything back together. But then the tree folded into itself is everything static. In order for things to stand out in space the way that they do, and in order for things to manifest, you need the split. And so it's a sacrifice. It's a necessary sacrifice in order for the expansion. The two are mutually interdependent. So yeah, I feel that that's the whole joke with Lilith, you know, is that she's this, you know, holographic representation of the thing, but there's a kernel of truth inherent in it, because it's, you know.
I do need to get out of my head, though. I've always been called heady, and for some reason, when people tell you that, when they say that you're heady, they think that they're being nice, and it's really a horrendous insult, you know. You're very heady. I get it. So, like, I don't live in the real world. I'm just working through things in my mind and making stuff up. And, you know, I'm intelligent, but I can't activate it in a way that has any, you know, real impact on anything. And I'm just spinning plates. Spinning plates. Just watching me spin plates, saying, "Oh, look at the heady man." And they say, "Exactly. That was a good illustration of being heady."
One of the premieres of the other one, like, why does weird shit happen with these fucking movies, damn it? It's like, I'm trying to fight off the Illuminati sayers, and yet it keeps proving itself to be true.
Alan, I want you to bring me back to eighth grade and to be explicit. I don't know if it's just because I'm not political or that's just not where my knowledge is at, but everyone says Batman's a fascist. And I just don't get that. I don't see it. I don't understand it. Make me see the light, because I don't know. I want to tune it out or something.
You got it. I'll give you a really, quick one. In it's the second Batman. I don't know, the one with the Joker. Is that the second Batman? Yeah.
Second.
That's second Nolan.
Right, okay, the Dark Knight. Nolan. Right. Exactly. And in there, he creates this whole system where he basically taps into everyone's cell phones to create this echolocation that he can find the Joker, right?
And beautiful.
And, you know, of course, you have Morgan Freeman there who says, "I really don't like this, and I'm gonna quit. God. I'm so upset that this breaks every rule of humanity, that we're just gonna, you know, infringe on everyone's civil liberties just to catch Madman. But just this once, I'll do it. It's so bad." And, you know, they make the point, what Gotham needs right now is a Dark Knight. They think they want a White Knight, so we're gonna trick them with Harvey Dent, and we'll let them believe that there was really a White Knight. But what they really fucking need is someone to bitch slap them hard. It's like, you know, they really need a Dark Knight. And I spoke to a lot of people who said, "Well, don't you think it's actually a commentary on police state tactics? Don't you think it's actually done to show how bad it really is?" And I'll be honest, I didn't feel that. I searched myself. I searched my interpretation of it. I searched the subtext of the film. And it just seems like, basically, if anything, a response to post 9/11, everyone, you know, the sort of, "Hey, we need to tap your phones, we need to listen to your voicemails, read your emails, do everything, and you know, it's like, this is what's necessary to fight terrorism. And then you see Batman doing the same thing, saying, there's just, it's just the, you know, what is it, drastic, oh God, I'm fucking brain dead right now. Like, you know, the drastic times call for drastic measures type deal. Like, I know you don't want to do it. I don't want to do it either. I don't want to infringe on everyone's civil liberties, but we just got to tap into everyone's cell phones. Otherwise, the Joker is going to kill everyone. And you notice they also make the point that particularly, this is a new thing for the Joker, in that film, he describes his political philosophy. The Joker says, I'm an anarchist. What I want is chaos. I'm an anarchist. So he's basically saying, we have to infringe on everyone's civil liberties and clamp down, otherwise it's going to be total anarchy. Well, what is anarchy? There's no power structure. So in order to keep the power structure, we have to infringe on everyone's civil liberties. To me, that's fascist. And that's,
well,
that's,
I don't think that that's infringing on what it is to be human. It might be infringing on what it is to be a citizen. But I find that citizenry is a symptom of history. And history is the nightmare for which the Dark Knight and everyone else is trying to awaken from. So I don't see that as...
I'm going to just throw something out. I know we can't really do it at this moment while we're talking, but if you can sort of keep this in your back of your mind, if you don't remember, I'm going to mention something that's probably a bit obscure. But there was a Disney cartoon called Darkwing Duck, which was basically Batman. It was totally fucking Batman. You know, and he actually poofs, you know, he has the whole smoke gun, which is actually really funny considering what we're talking about here with this guy, James Holmes, who puts the smoke in the theater and all that. But that was one of Darkwing Duck's biggest tools, was the smoke gun. But what he would do is, you know, he'd appear on this purple cape and say, you know, I'm the terror that flaps in the night. And he's all like trying to strike terror into the hearts of the criminals. Which is and it's so amazing because we keep saying terror. What is terrorist? What is a terrorist? Someone who promotes terror, a state of fear. And then we see politicians right. who promote a state of fear of we need this just so we can prevent right. such and such. Now, just to give you a thing, there was an episode of Darkwing Duck that really speaks to the latent fascist potential within Batman. It's not that Batman is inherently fascist, but that the potential is there. There's an episode of Darkwing Duck which involves a time machine, and his daughter accidentally stumbles into a time machine and goes into the future. And she goes into the future, and it's this totally dystopian fascist world, but the head of the dystopia is her father. And basically what happened is his daughter, in his mind, his daughter disappeared, presumably dead. So she just traveled to the future, but, you know, in those 30 years or whatever, she was gone. He assumed she died because he wasn't tough on crime enough. So he becomes this ultra-fascist where, like, somebody walking down the street, you know, breaks curfew and he, like, shoots them with a missile. And he does, like, all this crazy shit. And he turns into, like, this really dark version of Darkwing Duck. And I think that episode speaks to the latent fascist potential within the Batman.
So we're talking about this, but this motherfucker didn't want to be a vigilante.
No.
I mean, because he doesn't. That's the thing. That's why does everybody want to be the criminal? What the fuck is going on with our society where everybody wants to be the goddamn criminal? Fucking Spawn comic books? Is that what it happened? This whole dark hero motherfucking.
It wasn't cool unless it had chains.
I've
heard people argue that. Yeah, I'm not trying to argue that there's the. I'm not trying to argue that people are mind controlled into being the dark hero or the dark figure. I mean, certainly there is some of that. I mean, I think we have a fascination with it. We're dancing with it. You know, you see everything from Twilight, where it's saying we want to be vampires. Which, what are vampires? People who hurt each other and leech off of each other instead of people who love and support each other. You have, you know, most popular book right now is 50 Shades of Grey, which is all about your wife will like you better if you beat the shit out of her.
Hey, you know, I got some shit on that. I want to get it off my chest. I got some shit on that. First off, thank you for those books, because it is mommy porn and it drove my wife nuts. But this is what I want to say. That dude's name is Christian Grey, okay? And her name is Anastasia, I believe. But that whole book is Grey, Christian Grey, Christ, Alien, and Anastasia, Redheaded Babylon. And it drives me nuts because I'm like, what the fucking the odds of 2012 having the focus of this? I mean, isn't it 50 Shades of Grey? It's all it has to do with like sexuality and fucking aliens. Don't you see that? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I guess
what
you.
The fuck is going on? I mean, symbolically, and it's blatant symbolism too. The dude's name is Christian Grey. It's all about. There's bondage. There's all kinds of crazy shit in there. But is this what we need? Or is this like the Crowleyan way of sexualizing everything? Like, is our main problem as a civilization sexual repression?
So my mentioning last night of the woman who said to me, I thought I was crazy until I heard you speak. For me, that is really the nugget of this work and the most satisfying kind of comment that anybody could make, because what has happened since the 1960s is the straight people all went off together, and by this I don't refer to sexual preference, I use straight in the earlier sense. The straight people all went off and became very weird together, you know, with their golden Mercedes and their Picasso ceramics and all that. The freaks all went off and became strange alone, each apart in our own way, because community was shattered, affinity groups were suppressed. People went all kinds of directions. Now, the people who went through the 60s, approaching or in their 40s, have had 20 years to see how they like that kind of alienated aloneness. And so this morning as we went around, I heard many people saying, that they had done these things in the 60s, but not for a long time, and now they were returning to it. I think this is because it finally dawns on you that, you know, this may be the only shot you've got at it. I mean, reincarnation is fine, past lives are fine, but we're all getting daily older, and we don't know where we came from, you know, what lies beyond the zygote, and we don't know where we're going. What lies beyond the pine box? Who can say? So out of the incredible mystery of whatever the universe is, a microsecond of opportunity against impossible odds has sprung into being. We are embedded in that moment of opportunity. So what are you going to do with it? Are you going to sweep up around the ashram for 30 years and then decide that that was a mistake? Or, you know, are you going to just give yourself over to the arms of Holy Mother Church for a lifetime? I mean, people do this. You cannot escape making some kind of commitment to something. Nobody gets through life without being asked to sign up either in their own club or somebody else's. The mushroom said to me once, in the way that it does when it delivers these aphorisms, it said, you must have a plan. If you have no plan, you will become part of somebody else's plan. You either have a plan or you are part of somebody else's plan. And so I think people are waking up to the fact that we must use what works. Because you see, someone on this side of the room, when we went around, talked about, yoga and how the psychedelic gives the experience on demand, and but are we ready, and how do you gain skills, and this sort of thing. To my mind, the goal is not the psychedelic experience. The beginning of the path is the psychedelic experience. So if yoga promises that after 20 years it will deliver you to the beginning of the path, then, you know, there's something seriously wrong here. The psychedelic sets you at the beginning of the path, and then people do all kinds of things with it. I mean, I am amazed. I feel there is more variation in how we deal with this than in almost any other phase of human activity, because some people seem to have almost no self-reflection. And I've noticed it also touches sexuality, because I don't know how many of you have ever encountered the Penthouse Forum, but this is where people write into Penthouse and detail these astonishing sexual, unpredictable sexual exploits, threesomes, foursomes, and twelvesomes that just fell upon them. And whenever I have, for some reason, some occasion to read these things, what is amazing to me is that this appears to be descriptions of the behavior of an alien species, because there is no self-reflection on what does this mean? You know, what does this mean that I get stuck in an elevator and end up copulating with 12 stockbrokers? It's just accepted as how it is. Well, you get this same thing with psychedelics, where you say to someone and they say, oh yeah, in the 60s I took psychedelics. You know, wow, it was really strange. All these colors and voices and apparently no self-reflection, no realization that this is actually happening to you. This is happening to you. Therefore, the implications must be fairly central. And then other people immediately get it. They say, you know, my gosh, this plant, this pill shows me that reality is at least 1,000 times larger than I thought it was, showed me that I don't know who I am, where I am, what I am, or anything else. And I don't know what it takes to instill that in people, maybe intellectual self-reflection. One of the things that is so puzzling about shamans, when you actually deal with them in the field, is they are not like the other people in the tribe. The other people in the tribe are very tribal people. In other words, they have all the curious cultural limitations of people in every culture. They think you smell funny, they think you look funny, everything you do is amusing. They stand around in small groups giggling and pointing and like that. The shamans, on the other hand, it's nothing like that. They accept you totally as a person. They make no cultural judgments. You don't look funny, smell funny, so forth and so on, because they are what I call extra environmentals. They are deconditioned from the assumptions of their own culture.